Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming and welcome to the Johnson Sharma Graduate School of Public Policy for this, the third lecture in our distinguished speaker series on the subject of policy change. My name, as almost all of you I think already knows, is Jeremy Rayner, and I work here at the U of S campus of the school. But as indeed you all know as well, I think by now, we are one school, two campuses. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to our colleagues and guests at the University of Regina campus, where the event will be moderated by Dr. Ken Rasmussen, the Associate Director of the school. Now, our previous speakers in this series, you'll know, came from the American South and from the East Coast. Our speaker today comes from our own West Coast, British Columbia, Dr. Genevieve Fuji-Johnson. Attended Simon Fraser University, the London School of Economics, and as I always like to add, political science, and the University of Toronto before returning to SFU, where she is an associate professor teaching political theory in the political science department. Policy studies, rather more grandly in the Laswellian tradition, the policy sciences, are nothing, I think, if not multidisciplinary. We bring a wide variety of disciplinary backgrounds to the study of policy. And to me, at least, one of the most interesting of these disciplinary interactions is that between political theory, political philosophy, whatever we want to call it, and public policy. Dr. Johnson's own department is something of a trailblazer, I think, for this in Canada. I think of David Laycock and Laurent Dobuzinski as both distinguished exponents of the theory-policy interface. This political theory perspective is especially important in understanding policy change. Policy change, if we think about it for a moment, will usually intentionally, in fact, have the effect of redistributing, changing in some way, the benefits and burdens of public policy. And as such, questions of justice and fairness in these changes are never far away. Dr. Fuji-Johnson, in this respect, it's interesting to know, worked with the famous theorist of justice, Professor Brian Barry, when she was at the LSE. For these and for other reasons, which I'm sure she'll touch on in her talk today, we've become accustomed to the idea that proponents of change, whether they're government or other kind of governance agents, will engage and consult with those who are affected by policy changes. Sometimes only those directly affected, but often nowadays, broader public engagements and consultations. And it's in this field of engagement and democratic deliberation that Dr. Fuji-Johnson has done so much of her work and what she's going to talk about to us today. In her dissertation at the University of Toronto, she studied the consultations and engagement around that of my colleagues, and I can't resist repeating this, called the hot topic of nuclear waste management, a classic case, I think, that raises questions of equity over both time and space. It's a study that was published as Deliberative Democracy for the Future, the Case of Nuclear Waste Management in Canada by the University of Toronto Press, and has been translated into Japanese. She has co-edited with Darren Durant the collection Nuclear Waste Management in Canada, Critical Issues and Critical Perspectives. She currently holds a major SHRC grant to research practices of engagement in Canada, and I think she's going to share some of the preliminary outcomes of this research with us today. Her talk is entitled The Role of Ideals in Policy Change, Reflections on a Tenuous Relationship. Please join with me in a warm welcome to Dr. Genevieve Fuji-Johnson.
Thank you. That was lovely. So it's a great pleasure to be here today. I'd like to just begin with a brief note to the students listening today and in the audience. When I was preparing for this with this talk, I really started to long for my graduate student days. And so when I was thinking about what I would present to you today that you would find interesting as students of public policy, of course, focused on your studies, but also focused on your trajectory in terms of your future careers, I kept coming back to the themes of continuity, creative challenge, constant alertness, and change. So in terms of continuity, the foundations that you're laying now as students, lay them well, for they will serve you well in your careers if you choose to do so. In terms of creative challenge, tackle problems that do not present obvious answers. Find approaches to these problems that are novel, underdeveloped, not fully worked out. These will confound you, but also present to you opportunities of insight that might not otherwise, or that might otherwise be obscured by a path that is more straightforward. What I had in mind concerning constant alertness is different from constant critique. Critical thinking is, of course, the very essence of academic life, and as one notable a thinker in the Western political thought, or one notable philosopher in the history of Western political thought would put it, the very essence of a life worth living. But this doesn't mean that we should always be gadflies or naysayers or knee-jerk critics of social norms and government policy. Instead, drawing from Edward Said, constant alertness means a perpetual willingness to not let half-truths and received ideas steer one along. For Said, this requires a relentless scrutinizing of the world around us, scouring of alternative sources, exhuming buried documents, and revising forgotten or abandoned histories. And in terms of change, your foundations, the problems and challenges you set for yourself, and the critical but thoughtful and thought-probing methodology you employ to take your best shot at them will enable you, as your careers unfold, to adapt to new circumstances and new opportunities and to continue to make important contributions to public life. So with these broad themes of continuity, creative challenge, constant alertness, and change, I thought I would present to you some of the ideas that I've been grappling with since I was a graduate student and that I continue to grapple with more than a decade later. As some of you may know, as most of you know, I'm primarily a political theorist. I've always been interested in a selection of contributors to the history of Western political thought, contemporary Anglo-American political theory, feminist social and political thought, and certain critical and postmodern philosophies. But I've always been very interested in applying theories and theoretical concepts to specific areas of public policy. So the ideas that I'd like to discuss with you today, ideas that have inspired me to pursue my research agenda to date, but also ideas that have, quite frankly, caused me significant intellectual angst for creative challenge really is a euphemism for intellectual angst, emerge from my long-standing interest in both the fields of normative political theory and policy studies. And they can be expressed in two basic questions. What is the role of normative ideals in public policy development, implementation, and change? What is the relationship among political theory, policy studies, and policy making? And there are at least two broad answers to these basic questions. The first is that we want to minimize explicitly normative ideals in public policy because they are inherently subjective and can thus thwart attempts to study and make policy in a way that is rational. Rational policy, expressed in terms of efficiency, is impartial and thus better serves the citizen body than policy that is based on subjective norms. This response goes on. Political theory, which is the realm of normative ideals, tracing their histories, developing their meanings, teasing out their ambiguities, conflicts, and implications, it's an interesting area of study, but because of its inherently, necessarily subjective nature, it should have little bearing on the real world of politics and the real world of policy making. So another kind of response is that normative ideals are pervasive in all expressions, from mere descriptions of states of affairs to hypotheses tested by empirical studies to grand theories concerning the ideal political community and corresponding political regime. From this perspective, normative ideals necessarily pervade expressions made in and about policy processes, decisions and outputs. From this perspective, political theory should be an integral part of the education of students, analysts, and practitioners of policy. More generally, it should be a central component of a liberal education, liberal intended here as a reference to the freeing of the mind from dominant conceptions and misconceptions. Political theory should be an integral part of the formation of citizens. So for a number of years, I've been grappling with these two sets of responses, and I thought I would go public today with this long-standing internal grappling. Deborah Stone, in her acknowledgement to the policy paradox, mentions an imaginary auditorium full of colleagues, students, and intellectual adversaries, all, quote, listening in absentia, which is to say, inside my head. I can relate to this kind of ongoing internal dialogue, and I thought I would share some of this dialogue with you today. So the structure of my grappling, then, is political theory. I'll talk about political theory and explicit ideals. I'll talk briefly about the policy sciences and implicit ideals. I'll then talk about policy making with specific reference to some case studies that I've looked at over the past decade, really. And discuss these case studies in terms of ambiguity, contention, and pragmatic incrementalism. I'll then discuss implications for an already tenuous relationship. So in terms of political theory, normative political theorists and philosophers have long developed their ideals with direct reference to political life, institutions, procedures, and practices. With critical alertness, they have sought improvements to the political status quo and have advanced propositions encompassing the following types of political theories. So this is just a basic schema of four approaches to normative political theory. The first is grand schemes for political life. And here I have in mind Plato and Aristotle and their prescriptions for a unity of virtue and politics, that is, of good character and constitutions, to achieve eudaimonia, or ultimate happiness, which is a conception of happiness that is much richer, as political theorists might say, much thicker than conceptions of happiness or well-being that we find in utilitarianism. The second basic approach to political theory comprises conceptual frameworks or blueprints for political institutions. And here I'm thinking about Hobbes, Locke, and Rawls, who articulated principles for what they took as the most justifiable form of political institutions, given certain assumptions about the moral worth of men, the aims of men, and their collective circumstances, as well as the moderate scarcity of resources. So here we have frameworks for the distribution of goods, of primary goods. The third basic approach to political theory comprises procedural and substantive principles for political decision making. Coming to mind here are theories of deliberative democracy and theorists of deliberative democracy who are concerned with conceptualizing the best way to achieve legitimate and just public policy in light of strong beliefs in the fundamental moral equality of all individuals and the recognition of difference and conflict among individuals and groups. Finally, we have lines of social and political criticism. And here I'm thinking about theorists who have sought to uncover and expose various forms of exclusion, exploitation, alienation, violence, and cultural imperialism. And these theorists would include feminist, critical, postmodern, and postcolonial theorists. So, okay, what about the policy sciences and its relationship to normative ideals? Since the early days of the systematic study of public policy, proponents and practitioners of the policy sciences have been interested in ideals drawn from political theory. Indeed, Harold Lasswell, referred to by Gabriel Almond as the most original and productive political scientist of his time, was an idealist. Lasswell was concerned with addressing the fundamental problems facing humankind. He sought political, economic, and social change. He sought the rich ends of freedom and democracy. Lasswell, of course, would go on to make major contributions to developing a systematic study of policy development, implementation, and evaluation based on positivist tenets. Positivism, while explicitly suppressing normative ideals, is implicitly based on such ideals. So positivist philosophers of the 19th and 20th centuries focused their investigations on the empirically observable. These philosophers asserted that sound knowledge was derived from observation, or more generally, experience with empirical reality. They claimed that a proposition about the world, that is, a contingent proposition, would be meaningful only if it were empirically verified. Contrasted with analytic or a priori truths, which are based on the rules of logic, contingent truths were understood as having a verifiable bearing in the natural world. In the positivist view, statements not verified by experience or not derived from rules of logic were not only non-scientific, but they were literally nonsensical. So metaphysical, aesthetic, moral claims were rejected as meaningless or nonsensical. In addition to empirical verification, induction as a method of knowledge development was central to the positivist philosophers of science. And in the mid-20th century, Karl Popper critiqued the standard of verification and argued that the only reliable approach to amassing knowledge lay in rigorous attempts empirically to falsify causal generalizations. So there are normative ideals embedded in supposedly neutral, value-neutral approaches to studying policy and public life. These ideals relate to the notion of prioritizing definitive, singular, unified truth about political phenomena and expressed in language of facts, hypotheses, laws, and explanatory theories. They are ideals of prioritizing this truth and of accessing this truth through a combination of empirical observation, induction from multiple cases, and attempts at falsification. The field of policy sciences and policy studies has become diverse in recent times. This expansion of the field has involved how we conceptualize policy, the methods we use to understand policy, and the normative standards we refer to in developing, implementing, and studying policy. There is now a healthy body of post, or I think more aptly, non-positivist approaches to policy that are, by definition, explicitly normative. So the overarching non-positivist argument is that in their tendency to obscure the normative nature of policy processes and policy, more mainstream approaches often unreflectively uphold the values typically associated with rationality and economic efficiency and expressed in terms of quantities to the exclusion of other non-quantifiable values. Non-positivist approaches, for example, interpretive, discursive, ethical approaches, seek to identify and clarify values at play in a policy area, to understand the context in which they are embedded, and to critique the social, political, and economic structures in which they are articulated. Ultimately, I think they want to expose the values that may be unjustifiably upheld at the expense of other values and the power relations that serve in this prioritization. Normative ideals typically sought by non-positivist approaches include freedom from domination, a more equitable distribution of material resources, greater political economy, equality, and wide public discourse and debate on what to value and how to value it. Okay, so what about policy making? What about policy development and implementation? How are ideals conceptualized and treated in the real world of public policy? So a number of my projects over the last decade or so have involved my drawing from a contemporary political theory, an ideal of deliberative democracy, identifying its key normative principles and applying these in an evaluation of cases involving organized forms of public participation and citizen engagement. So far, I've looked at three such cases, and I'm beginning to work on a fourth. These cases include social housing in Toronto, energy policy in Nova Scotia, and nuclear waste management at the federal level in Canada. The fourth case that I am completely unprepared to talk about is the case of language policy in Nunavut. It's a very interesting policy area. I will say that much about it. And Nunavut is an amazing area of the country. So over the past 30 years or so, it seems that both political theorists and policy practitioners have become enchanted with the concept of deliberative democracy and its various conceptualizations. Procedures and practices based on principles of democracy, of deliberative democracy, continue to multiply in numerous areas of policy at all levels of governance, from urban planning to resource management, hazardous waste management, language protection, and areas beyond. Policymakers are drawing, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly, from this rich literature on theories of deliberative democracy to inform processes of policy. So theories of deliberative democracy explain why we ought to seek ethically justifiable policies and how our governance structures and orientations ought to be organized in order to realize this aim. Ideally, public decisions would be based on the informed and well-reasoned agreement of all those governed or affected by these decisions. So it's a very rich ideal. However, in the cases that I've examined, themes that emerge with respect to this rich ideal coming out of a very rich philosophical and theoretical body of material bearing upon principles about the fundamental moral equality of all individuals, the importance of agreement in the laws and policies that govern us, is essentially being reduced to a pragmatic tool for very incremental changes. So the themes that I've observed in the cases I've looked at are ambiguity, contention, and pragmatic incrementalism. What I've observed is the pragmatic use of procedures derived from this ideal and the outputs of these procedures toward incremental change in policy processes. In the cases I've looked at, policymakers tend to use ideals to the extent that they serve pre-existing interests, confronting immediate problems, and seeking modest change. So the use of ideals is necessarily, it seems, curtailed by contexts of complex constellations of often competing factors emerging from policy histories and involving actors, interests, institutions, and events. Ideals are made to submit to contextual factors. The overarching result seems to be the morphing of normative ideals into pragmatic policy tools toward fairly modest change. The rich ends of normative ideals for political life, expressed as they are in political theory, in grand schemes, institutional frameworks and blueprints, procedural principles and lines of critique, are all potentially reduced to a basic pragmatism toward incremental change. So the Toronto Community Housing Corporation also known as the TCHC, was formed in 2002 and was the first public housing corporation in North America to adopt participatory budgeting, which reflects principles of deliberative democracy. The TCHC is one of the largest social housing providers in North America, with approximately 164 tenants. It operates at arm's length from the City of Toronto, which is the company's sole shareholder. During the period of my study, the TCHC's management structure was organized into 27 fairly autonomous community housing units, also known as CHUs. So this is just a basic schema of the tenant representation process. So tenants in their council address issues, they set priorities, they allocate resources, and make decisions with respect to their communities, their local communities. And this is the basic timeline for participatory budgeting. Building meetings, CHU council meetings, at which they develop a CHU plan, with a list of priorities for spending, capital expenditures in particular. And then, of course, they meet at an inter-CHU or I-CHU group in March and April. So in 2003, the beginning of the TCHC's first participatory budgeting cycle, more than 6,000 tenants allocated $10 million in capital expenditures. In 2005, tenants allocated $9 million to capital expenditures for each cycle. Tenants thus allocated $7.2 million per cycle in 2005, 6, 7, and 8 to the CHUs, according to their numbers of housing units. These funds were distributed according to priorities established during inclusive and democratic meetings among tenants and staff within each CHU. During each of these budgetary cycles, an additional 1.8 was allocated during a one-day democratic forum involving delegates from all 27 CHUs meeting in the inter-CHU forum. Decisions made during the CHU council meetings and during these 1.8 days were generally accepted by the CEO and board of directors and implemented by the TCHC management. Finally, local CHU monitoring committees made up of both tenants and staff would oversee the implementation of the projects specific to their communities. So another case that I'm looking at is the case of Nova Scotia Power. Nova Scotia Power is the province's main electricity provider and is regulated under the Public Utilities Act and the Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board. It owns approximately 2,300 megawatts of generating capacity, primarily from coal, about 75% from coal, but also natural gas and oil, as well as some hydro. It's also recently brought on about 300 megawatts of energy from renewable sources. So in 2004, NSP held Canada's first deliberative poll based on Jim Fishkin's methodology, which incidentally is trademarked. And incidentally, just as an aside, it's very difficult actually to cut and paste images and logos from his site. So you can visit his website, the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University. So NSP's Customer Energy Forum involved a statistically representative sample of 135 of its customers. The aim of this poll was to involve Nova Scotians in developing NSP's future energy plan, both in terms of supply as well as demand-side management. Participants arrived at the two-day Customer Energy Forum having received background materials that were developed by an advisory council comprising individuals from a range of backgrounds. So these materials were very robust and very balanced, I would say. They were immediately administered a pre-deliberation survey. During plenary sessions, participants had opportunities to ask the expert panels questions on the different options. During small group discussions, independent moderators sought to ensure the equal and respectful participation of all group members. At the end of the event, participants were administered a post-deliberation survey. So participants had a wide range of views, but they converged, indeed reaching a broad agreement on the need for more renewable energy, for lowering emissions from existing power plants, and for greater energy efficiency in their homes and businesses. And they indicated very clearly that they were willing to pay for more greener sources. The nuclear energy Organization, the nuclear, sorry, the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, also known as the NWMO, was established in 2002 by three of Canada's nuclear energy corporations. So this, I studied this prior to the existence of Bruce Power, which is a private entity, as I'm sure you know. But I guess nonetheless would be considered Canada's fourth nuclear energy corporation. Anyway, at the time in 2002, there were three nuclear energy corporations: Ontario Power Generation, Hydro-Québec, and New Brunswick Power. Atomic Energy of Canada Limited also played a role in forming the NWMO. It was formed as a private entity. Regulated by the federal government. As directed by the Nuclear Fuel Waste Act of 2002, the NWMO was responsible for studying waste management options for Canada's used nuclear fuels, proposing to the government its preferred option, and implementing the option chosen by government. The NWMO thus launched in 2003. An impressive national consultation process comprising more than 20 dialogues based on deliberative democratic principles toward the end of identifying collaboratively with Canadians on an option for Canada's nuclear fuel waste. All of the dialogues were based on principles of respect for the equality of participants and their views. Facilitators sought to ensure that participants had an equal voice in deliberations. The conclusions drawn by the NWMO of these dialogues included wide agreement that the waste management and/or disposal option needs to be socially acceptable, and that opportunities must be created for any interested Canadian to participate in the processes of selecting and implementing this option. The NWMO ultimately recommended to the federal government an adaptive phased management approach, which was accepted in 2007. This approach is an amalgam of on-site storage, which is the status quo. 90% of the waste is located around the Toronto area. Centralized storage and deep geological disposal implemented over a protracted time frame, including an incremental decision-making process, an ongoing monitoring system, and waste retrievability. So all three cases, we see procedures based directly on principles of deliberative democracy. It's hard to find fault with the procedures themselves. They were inclusive and fair. Deliberations transpiring from them were informed and reasoned. Really, these were textbook cases of deliberative democratic procedures in the real world. Nonetheless, what emerges are themes of ambiguity, contention, and pragmatic incrementalism in the context of complexity, characterized by lengthy policy histories. Contention among stakeholders, constraints of policy requirements, and incentives and disincentives related to economic and strategic interests. So in terms of ambiguity, we see in this case an ambiguity of elites, an ambiguity of elite motives for seeking to realize principles of deliberative democracy. In each case, we see an ostensible commitment on the part of elites to realizing principles of deliberative democracy in their processes. Elites consistently sang praises of the normative ends of deliberative democratic approaches, of the deliberative democratic approaches that they were taking, participatory budgeting, deliberative polling, stakeholder dialogues. But on digging deeper, I conducted about 15 interviews in each policy areas, open-ended interviews that lasted about an hour or so, and in some cases I was able to follow up with the people I interviewed. But on digging deeper, I found that elites articulating the value of deliberative democracy to address their own agendas situated in complex contexts. So TCHC elites, for example, talked about the difficulties of the TCHC being an amalgamation of two social housing organizations that were previously run by the province of Ontario in the early 2000s. An amalgamation that was initiated by provincial budget cuts and offloading services to municipalities. Elites talked about the need to adopt a management approach that would be sustainable in this context, that would be effective in distributing increasingly limited funds for capital upgrades that are much needed, that were much needed and continue to be much needed, while not alienating tenants. In terms of the NSP, elites acknowledged recent policy requirements to diversify their energy portfolio away from coal, which may be a challenge that this province is facing as well, and to bring on new renewables. This was a major issue, and it was a theme that really came out in my interviews. They spoke directly of the strategic importance to inform, educate, and consult with Nova Scotians on their energy options. The deliberative poll may have served to justify proposed rate hikes to offset the cost of bringing on more renewables, which is very expensive, involving large expenditures with respect to, involving large capital, upfront capital expenditures. So similarly, the NWMO, at the NWMO, elites acknowledged policy requirements to consult with Aboriginal nations and the Canadian public, and they recognized the strategic importance of garnering public acceptance of a nuclear waste management plan, especially in light of a very long history of fairly vociferous anti-nuke movement in Canada. So not surprisingly, we see a lot of contention among members of the policy communities concerning the purposes of the deliberative democratic principles and practices, as well as the outputs of these practices and procedures and the use of these outputs. So tenants at the TCHC express contention concerning their control of only a small portion of the capital budget, between $9 and $10 million of an operating budget of approximately $500 million, which could be used for only very limited and localized projects. Tenants were also disappointed by the reluctance on the part of TCHC elites to institute an ongoing citywide tenant decision-making body. Moreover, they expressed disappointment concerning basic building maintenance and standards. Many raised questions about the commitment of the TCHC to tenant participation and empowerment. We see conflicting perspectives in the NSP policy community with respect to the deliberative poll and its use. Some felt that participants were not adequately representative of Nova Scotians and that important constituents were left out or excluded, especially those in lower income brackets, which does tend to be a problem with this particular approach to engaging citizens, which is a finding that comes out of James Fishkin's work. There was also conflict around the significance of the pool for energy policy in the province. Several stakeholders saw it primarily as an exercise in PR, as NSP was obligated by provincial policy to bring on more renewables. With respect to the NWMO's consultation process, we see a lot of contention. Aboriginal organizations in particular felt that their views were not incorporated into the policy recommendation. Environmental organizations, as well as the United Church of Canada, had similar perspectives. A number of participants in the dialogues specified the absolute importance of clarifying the role of nuclear energy in the country's existing and future energy portfolio before deciding on a viable waste management and disposal system. They felt that the NWMO's consultation process served to legitimize the nuclear energy's industry, the nuclear energy industry's preference for deep geological disposal, which was articulated way back in the 1970s, and its preference for a continued nuclear energy program for the country. So ultimately, what I've observed in this case is a kind of pragmatic incrementalism, and I'm using this term loosely, recognizing that both pragmatism and incrementalism are fairly specific approaches. But what I've observed in these cases is that policy elites are ambiguous about the use of overarching ideals, given policy histories and contexts. They recognize the importance of normative ideals with respect to deliberative democracy, so the ideals of inclusion and dialogue and agreement. But these ends are often placed in the background. Foregrounded are much more pragmatic considerations relating to existing policy requirements, strategic considerations, economic interests, to make incremental change in very complex contexts. So just as an aside, my book on deliberative democracy and nuclear waste management was translated into Japanese last year. I'm not following this case very closely, but I am periodically in touch with the translator of my book, Professor Harutoshi Funabashi. In light of the near total meltdown of several reactors at the Daiichi